You're listening to the However Improbable podcast, a Sherlock Holmes book club that narrates and discusses Arthur Conan Doyle's classic tales. We're reading them in the order they occurred in the lives of the great detective and his good doctor.
Holmes himself famously said that there's nothing new under the sun, but we're willing to give him a run for his money. I'm Sarah Cole.
And I'm Marissa Mercurio. This week, Holmes is hired by a young clerk to investigate a suspiciously good job offer and ends up in a case of identity theft and robbery. It's the adventure of the stockbroker's clerk.
Stockbroker's Clerk was published in The Strand in 1893, and in the short story collection The Memoirs of Sherlock Holmes, it's the 16th Holmes story published. Tracking our chronology, Baring Gould places it on June 15th, 1889, a few days after the Boscombe Valley mystery, which we talked about last time. We'll discuss why this doesn't make a ton of sense in a minute. To listen to our audio adaptation, go back an episode. We will be here.
In the adventure of the stockbroker's clerk, Watson has moved out and is on his own. We learn that Watson has bought an ailing doctor's practice to get back to his former glory. Meanwhile, he hasn't seen Holmes for 3 months until Holmes shows up at his door. Holmes whisks Watson away to Birmingham while their client, a cockney clerk named Hall Prycroft, explains his circumstances. After being laid off, Prycroft is finally hired at a well-to-do stockbroking firm.
This just occurred to me that Pycroft just rhymes with Mycroft, which is kind of ridiculous.
Mycroft, Pycroft, could throw a few others in there.
I don't know. Oh, Doyle. Anyway, trying to explain this plot to you all, a few days before starting his new job, a man named Pinner shows up to his Pycroft's home, not Mycroft's home, to offer him a great role at a firm Pycroft has never heard of. Pycroft notices both the brothers he works for have a gold tooth and realizes that they're the same person. In disguise. When Holmes, Watson, and Pycroft arrive at Pinner's temporary office, they find him grief-stricken and agitated. Out of nowhere, he hangs himself, but is rescued by Watson.
Holmes explains that Pinner and some compatriots sought to remove Pycroft from his job at Mostyn's firm so that a famous forger named Beddington, Pinner's brother, could impersonate him. In the midst of a robbery, Beddington is noticed by a security guard who Beddington kills. He is nevertheless caught and the money recovered. The story concludes with Holmes rhapsodizing about human nature before calling the police to connect the two apprehensions. Well,
that's about as concise a summary as we can get. This is a weird story.
I struggled a little
bit. The plot is with this one. Bizarre.
Once it came together, I was entertained, and I will say that that one moment when Pinner hangs yes. himself, yeah. I was genuinely shocked. And I
it's really kind of gruesome.
I gasped out loud because I was like, whoa, like you usually don't see something so closely in these stories. There's the other, what's the one with the bank robbers and the three guys come back to get him, and he's been, and they hang him. It's the one with the guy who is a young doctor.
I don't remember.
And they're Russian.
What that's called, but because I don't remember.
It's the resident patient, I think. Oh. Is that right?
Yes. Yes. Yeah, because that has that doctor in it.
Okay.
So, you are correct.
All this to say, I was thinking about the resident patient, because in the resident patient, the man who is killed in that story is hanged by his his compatriots who had robbed the bank. But it happens off stage. Like, Holmes and Watson are told the following morning that this guy has supposedly killed himself, but we don't see it. He doesn't kill himself, he's been hanged, he's been killed, but it still happens, like, way off stage. Whereas in this one, it's like, in the other room, they break down the door. It's very shocking. Watson has
Watson's
to resuscitate
like pulling
this guy.
Off of his makeshift noose. Yeah, oftentimes the real, like, there's often action sequences, but like real violence is not super present in these stories, and this was kind of notable for that reason, I think.
Mm-hmm. And if I recall correctly, there's a good illustration with Holmes and Watson bursting through the door.
Oh, cool.
To, like, be like, something's happening. it culminates.
Gargling and gurgling.
Yeah, it's, like, such a shocking moment, really.
Yeah.
it's like you don't expect such a tepid mystery to culminate in that way.
Mm-hmm. Other than, I think, some interesting things about Watson and what he's up to, I think that's the most interesting part of the story for me, is that, like, a real tone switch, because it starts out kind of bland.
And confusing as well.
And confusing. And then all of a sudden, it's ramped up to this very dramatic sequence of Watson saving this guy's life.
Mm-hmm. But why don't we get back to the timeline and start yes. with where we are in this story.
Yeah, so I just wanted to mention this just because we loosely follow Baron Gould's chronology. And he's not foolproof, and things get a little bit muddled. And this is one of those instances where, like, broadly, the story is placed in the right spot. But the timing is a little bit odd because Watson tells us very specifically that he hasn't seen Holmes in 3 months. But Baring Gould has put the story in June 1889. And then last time we saw them in, like, April or May of 1889, right mm-hmm. after Watson got married. So there's some, like, a couple of months that are missing in this.
Right, it doesn't really make
sense. In this chronology
sense.
That doesn't make a ton of sense. We also get a lot of, like, Holmes makes some references to, I hope Mrs. Watson has recovered after the sign of four that, like, that just happened.
I feel like Conan Doyle is constantly referring to the sign of four, and we're like, I know. We get it. We get it.
I'm aware. I know. I hated it, and I don't want you to talk about it anymore. Leave it alone. Yeah, so that's, I mean, roughly we're in summer 1889, but that threw me for a loop a little bit just because I feel like things were kind of tidy, and then this is less tidy, but definitely post-wedding, Watson has moved out. Watson is trying to reinvigorate his medicine practice, which I think we should talk about next because this kind of made me feel proud of him.
Yeah, although there is one tiny little detail that I don't know where else to put because it's not really relevant to the plot at all before we talk about Watson in more depth, is that Holmes's voice is described as having a, quote, high, somewhat strident tone. I always like these little details that we get about Holmes's voice because we're often reminded that his voice is a lot higher than I think yeah. he is depicted in popular culture. I mean, especially if you're mm-hmm. thinking about someone like Benedict Cumberbatch, who has a very deep
yeah,
voice.
That deep, like, bass mm-hmm. baritone.
Yeah, so I think it's interesting because he's often portrayed as, like, this, especially with the, like, the 40s adaptations, this, like, hyper-masculine figure. Mm-hmm. And in reality, the Conan Doyle was describing him with, like, a more high-pitched voice, which mm-hmm. I think is a nice reminder of the distinction between many adaptations and what we actually get in the text.
Yeah, and sort of what becomes popularized because you think of one actor and then people yes. are emulating that idea rather than emulating what's actually in the books. Yeah.
Right. So,
and
that's
strident,
it.
Which I like, as he's, you know, a little high-pitched and a little bit demanding in the way
yes.
that he's talking.
One might say whiny, if they're being ungenerous.
Perhaps. Watson's in a good mood today, so he does not.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But let's talk about Watson, because this is a big Watson story, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, he, I mean, he has the most to do, actually, of anybody, because mm-hmm. he does resuscitate this guy who tries to kill himself. So Watson, we learn, has purchased a doctor's practice from this older ailing gentleman and is really busy. And he's been busy for 3 months. And I like there's this detail where Holmes is observing, like, how worn away the steps are in front of his house versus his neighbor's house. His mm-hmm. neighbor's also a doctor. And the steps in front of Watson's house are more worn away, which means he's busier. So lots of people are coming to Watson for
right.
their medical needs, which, you know, good
it's
for
nice.
Watson.
But meanwhile, I mean, given the weirdness of the timeline, but we know he hasn't seen Holmes for 3 months, he says.
A while, yes.
A while. And meanwhile, Watson has been reading over his notes of old cases, which I think is very sweet. And
yeah, Holmes does this little dig of, because the story starts where Watson's at home, Holmes shows up and is like, hey, I have this weird little problem if you're not too busy to hang out with me. And Watson's like, no, it's
Watson's
fine.
Super eager. It's nice. He's like, gung-ho, he's ready to go.
But Holmes he's kind of fishing for Watson to say, like, no, I still want to investigate crime with you. And he goes, the cares of medical practice have not entirely obliterated the interest which you used to take in our little deductive problems.
You used to.
Oh, like 2 days ago. It's fine. Yeah, they were just doing the Boscombe Valley mystery where they, like, I mean, were sitting in a hotel talking about crime. They didn't solve a ton of crime, but they nonetheless were doing that.
Mm-hmm.
So Watson says he's too busy to visit Baker Street and that Holmes seldom went anywhere unless it was related to the business mm-hmm. of solving crime. So Holmes does not drop by for chit-chat.
No, of course not.
And because this case is, like, kind of, I can imagine Holmes being like, eh, I wonder if Watson's kind of bored. Like, I'm going to ask him to come along with me because it's not the most interesting mm-hmm. crime ever, except for, again, the sort of drama in the middle of it. So
right.
I feel like he's maybe fabricating a reason for them to hang out together.
I would not put that past him. Because, I mean, honestly, how much does Watson really do in the story? I mean, at the end, he certainly is very crucial to saving this man's life. But in terms of mystery solving,
No, he is a vehicle for Hall Pycroft to, like, tell the story a second time to him. He contributes nothing. I think I do like that, like, the story starts with this framework about his medical practice and he's busy and this is what he's up to. And then he uses his medical skills to kind of, like, intervene in the situation. So mm-hmm. that's kind of a nice thread.
Yes. I always like cases where we get to see Watson do a little bit of his particular expertise that Holmes mm-hmm. cannot do.
Yeah. Dr. Action Watson in this case. And also, let me find this. He describes himself as having youth and energy.
Hmm.
So he's feeling pretty upbeat and, you know, it's pretty healthy and pretty good, even though he
phase.
Recently had a cold.
Yeah, that's
yeah,
true. He's just been married. He's got his practice together. He's still
life
solving mysteries. It's going. Things are going really good for him mm-hmm. right now. Enjoy it while it lasts, Watson.
Yeah, that's not going to last forever. As we know, what's on the horizon. Holmes also says that Watson looks robust.
Mm.
Which I think is a compliment, but also a little rude. And Mary gets mentioned in passing, but that's it.
Yeah, I don't
Her
think
name comes up,
we are going to get a lot of Mary going forward.
No.
Of, like, actual
Yeah, she
presence.
Might have, like, well, at some point in time, she calls Watson the wrong name, and I
that's
don't remember
true.
What story that happens in. So that's going to happen sometime in the future, but poor Mary.
Right. Sorry, Mary. But Holmes and Watson do have a nice little exchange while they're catching up a little bit. Mm-hmm. I like this moment when Holmes says, quote, "I am afraid that I rather give myself away when I explain. Results without causes are much more impressive," which we know. Yeah.
Yes.
I mean, like, Watson knows, but it's funny to me that Holmes is still trying to impress Watson a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Because yeah, all the way back to the first story.
However long they've been friends. I mean, it's been a number
years.
Of years at this mm-hmm. point, and he still, I think, gets delight on doing his deductive trick, and Watson never fails to go, "Wow, that's so amazing." Even when he's going, "Well, you looked like you were sick, and now you're not sick anymore," which is a silly thing to be deducing, but that's, you know, that's what they're up to.
Gosh, should we talk a little bit about the plot? Try
yes.
to untangle
let's,
that.
Let's
a little
try.
Bit?
I had a really a hard time. I had to read the story a couple of times to kind of parse what's happening, and because most of the reveal of, like, what the actual crime was and why these two bank robbers or whatever they are were actually trying to commit identity fraud, it's all told secondhand through this newspaper article that Watson reads out loud at the end of the story. I think all it just, like, Doyle does this a lot in this kind of, like, secondary accountings of experiences and embedding newspaper stories and that kind of thing into his stories. In this case, it didn't was not effective, and it really just confused me. Because none of it was happening in front of them except for, like, the very culmination of all of these events, which they happened to kind of just appear and walk into the room and scare this guy into.
Yeah, me as well. It's a lot of following things secondhand and not seeing them for ourselves, which always creates, like, the one step of remove always makes it a little bit more difficult to comprehend. And then when you have people who are doing, like, multiple identities, people are like, "I'm, like, they're brothers," and then
yeah,
you're like,
was,
"What? Who's related to who? Are they the same person?"
But there were one person pretending to be brothers, but there were two bank robbers, but they were not
the people pretending to be the employers.
And then there's this other guy that they push in at the end who is like, this guy's an expert forger. And we're like, okay, yeah. Sure.
All right, I guess so. And all of this is to get a sample of Hal Pycroft's handwriting. Right? Like, that's the goal of their, like, fake business where they ask him to, like, write down a list of mm-hmm. a bunch of shops or something.
Right.
It just seems like there should have been an easier way to go about
it. I feel like there's a simpler way to tell this story.
Yeah.
But I do think this story of all the ones that we've read so far is notable for its dual arrests. So we have Bennington in London and then Pinner in Birmingham that are, right. they're both getting arrested working on the same, on the same heist, essentially, but mm-hmm. in different locations. And Holmes's role is a lot more about explaining to Pycroft what happened rather than doing a lot of solving. Right. And as we talked about a little bit, and then I think the other notable thing is that all this takes place in like one day.
Yeah, it's a pretty short, it's like 2 or 3 hours, really.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, because they're really entering into this. Obviously, the stuff, like the stuff that Pycroft has been going through has been going on for a period of time.
Mm-hmm.
These crimes have been committed for a period of time, and it all kind of comes to a head, largely because Holmes and Watson enter into this fake business and they scare the crap out of the thief who... they're pretending, Holmes is pretending to be an accountant or something, but it does not work, and he's pretty sure he's a detective, and that's when he goes off and tries to hang himself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so Holmes, I think, presumably does bring Pinner to the police, but we never actually see the police in action in this story, mm-hmm. And the arrest only, again, presumably happens after the attempted suicide.
Yeah, yeah, the story kind of ends like right before they get the police involved.
Yeah. Which isn't uncommon. Most of the stories do not directly involve the police, or at least don't directly involve them in a like meaningful plot driven way. So that's not unusual. That's of a part with most of the home stories, I would say. But yeah, a lot of like this one still feels very like without action, except for the big shock at the end. It's a lot of people just walking around and talking to each other and telling stories
like
of like,
in a cab
and then this happened, yeah. and then this happened, and then this happened, uh-huh. and then I read this in a newspaper. The story is, it's unique, but that's not a compliment necessarily. but it does have a couple of elements that reminded me specifically of like Red-Headed League.
Mm-hmm.
And were there any others that felt similar
there
to you?
I feel like it's, I feel like you see this with a lot of these stories that clearly were Doyle kind of just trying to check a word count or like check needing to publish something. And so he's pulling on a lot of threads that he does a lot better in other stories that are a lot more well known. This one is not super notable and not super well known, and I hadn't read it in years and years. So this feels a lot like the Red-Headed League to me, where people who are committing crimes are trying to trick someone into a weird job to get something out of them. There also are some elements of the Three Garadebs in there, which is like this hoax trying to clear the way for a crime to take place. And I also think it has some similarities to the Copper Beeches, which we read fairly recently, because it's like weird job offer that's too good to be true,
yes,
and that the person in this case is kind of suspicious of.
Mm-hmm.
And they're bringing that to Holmes, being like, help me parse what's happening. There's no way this is real, right? Like, what's going on? Why am I being paid so much money? Which is the case in Copper Beeches. And in this story is that Violet Hunter and Hall are like, this is like, I have a bit bad feeling about this, right? Like, help me figure it out.
Right.
And that's how Holmes gets involved. I actually think like Hall Pycroft is a kind of a nice character because I think he's a lot more aware that something is going on
that's
and
true.
That things are fishy, certainly than the guy in the Red-Headed League who is completely clueless
just
about people
right
digging
over his
a hole
head.
In
yeah,
his
absolutely.
Pawnbroker shop. in that case, Holmes is asked to investigate something silly and then ends up finding a real crime. But yeah, it just feels like it's emulating a lot of things that we see in other stories.
Yeah.
A lot better structure.
Agreed. This one is, again, very, I think, tepid, very low on the action. And then that is not supported by actual mystery solving. So it's not like there's a lot of cool puzzles that are being investigated by Holmes in this one. It's, again, just a lot of secondhand information being recounted.
Redheaded League, which, I mean, it's easy to talk about because I think it's one of the best stories out there, but it has great villain.
Yes.
In the story, the villains, even though there's probably something interesting, and it sounds like the background story of them committing this crime and coming up with this scheme would be interesting to, like, delve more into, but they're, like, non-entity characters.
Right.
Where that, the culmination of Holmes and the, whatever that guy's name is, kind of standing off the end of Redheaded League is so good.
It's very good. Totally. Well, should we talk about the attempted suicide, Watson's intervention? Yes. Obviously, I think a little bit of a content warning here if you want to skip, because we're going to read a passage that I think is particularly detailed.
Yeah, pretty gruesome. So, yes, noted. We'll put some notes in the show notes, too, about the suicide conversation in this.
So this is right really at the end of the story, almost. This is not the suicide. Gosh, this is gross, though. Some of the redemption of the story is some of the writing. Just a couple passages.
Yeah. This is, like, when they walk into the office to confront Mr. Pinner, right?
Right. So I guess what we could say is that this really sets the stage for what happens in a few minutes. But I do particularly like this passage where Watson is describing this man that they are encountering, this criminal. He writes, "At the single table sat the man whom we had seen in the street, with his evening paper spread out in front of him, and as he looked up at us, it seemed to me that I had never looked upon a face which bore such marks of grief, and of something beyond grief, of a horror such as comes to a few men in a lifetime. His brow glistened with perspiration, his cheeks were of the dull, dead white of a fish's belly, and his eyes were wild and staring. He looked at his clerk as though he failed to recognize him, and I could see by the astonishment depicted upon our conductor's face that this was by no means the usual appearance of his employer." So I think that's a really captivating moment.
Which also just makes me think that, like, this guy has a story.
Mm-hmm.
That Doyle is alluding to a little bit. We just don't get to hear him express it.
Yeah, it would have been, I think, so much... like, because he's reading the paper where he's found out about the arrest in London, right? So it would have been so much more engaging if we had been able to do a little bit more movement between London and Birmingham, had been able to, like, go witness that arrest or set it up, or had Holmes more directly involved with the actual crime before just coming in at the end.
A lot of cases where then, like, they make an arrest or they figure out who did it, and Holmes kind of asks the person for an explanation, which is always a structure that I really like, is, like, Holmes and Watson sitting in a lawn chair and some guy, or in their lawn chair, in their chairs in their house, and they're kind of putting some guy on trial who's explaining himself. I think that could have elevated this story, to just get this guy to explain the events on his own. Rather than just, like, then reading the paper.
Yeah, okay, so here's the actual moment when Holmes and Watson discover the attempted suicide. "Again and again, much louder, came the rat-tat-tat. We all gazed expectantly at the closed door. Glancing at Holmes, I saw his face turn rigid, and he leaned forward in intense excitement. Then suddenly came a low gargling sound, and a brisk drumming upon woodwork. Holmes sprang frantically across the room and pushed at the door. It was fastened on the inner side. Following his example, we threw ourselves upon it with all our weight. One hinge snapped, then the other, and down came the door with a crash. Rushing over it, we found ourselves in the inner room. It was empty." And then it moves forward a little bit to a coat and waistcoat laying on the floor, a hook behind a door, and finding, quote, "his own braces around his neck, hanging the managing director of the Franco-Midland Hardware Company. His knees were drawn up, his head hung at a dreadful angle to his body, and the clatter of his heels against the door made the noise which had broken in upon our conversation. In an instant, I had caught him around the waist and held him up while Holmes and Pycroft untied the elastic bands which had disappeared between the livid creases of skin. Then we carried him to the other room where he lay in a clay-colored face, puffing his purple lips in and out with every breath, a dreadful wreck of all that he had been but 5 minutes before.
Yeah.
Whew. And then Watson it's goes really on to vivid. Examine him. Yes. It was very intense. I mean, like, hanging yourself with your like, suspenders.
Yeah, his suspenders or his belt. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's, whew. It's intense.
Yeah, this is happens so fast. Interesting that the story itself is kind of bland, but the moments of really good writing are really good writing.
Yeah. And some of the most action that we see, I think, in the Holmes stories. Really high stakes, too.
Yeah,
like,
no kidding.
Immediate high stakes, happens really quickly. Like, they're in one room, the guy leaves the room, and then all this happens.
Yeah, it's really vivid and really visual, and it just, like, such a contrast from anything else that's happening or anything else that we've seen recently. Mm-hmm. We've seen a lot of, like, creepiness, like, Copper Beach, as we talked a lot about, just being eerie and creepy and just kind of gross, but that not violent or physical in this mm-hmm. way. So, yeah, I really had forgotten all about this.
Yeah, I don't think we've had anything as violent since we've read Hound of the Baskervilles.
No, yeah.
I mean, that guy, I guess, in Copper Beaches does get torn apart by dogs also.
That's true.
But this just feels like so much
more. But that's
more
not described
immediate.
In this way.
Right.
Yeah.
Like, this feels real. Like, this feels very realistic and unpleasant.
And also knowing that, you know, Doyle is also a doctor. Right. He's not completely fabricating. Like, obviously it's a little sensational, but he's not fabricating some of these details. I think they must be rooted in a little bit of his, like, knowledge of the human body.
Right. And that does tie nicely together with, like, Watson having his practice at the beginning of the story with getting to actually enact some medical work at the end.
Yeah, like you said earlier, I really love any story that lets the things that Watson is good at shine. And I think in this case, he really has this moment where he gets to take the lead and, like, resolve this situation. And Holmes probably could not have. And if he had not brought Watson along, this guy might have died.
Yeah, I think very likely. There's moments that are really interesting in this story. It's not a total loss. It's just would have been nice if there had been more thought to the structure of the mystery.
Yeah, I agree. I feel like Doyle was a little bored, perhaps, when he wrote it. And as a result, I'm a little bored when I'm reading it. With moments, like, exceptions. But
right.
They don't permeate through the whole thing. And the, like, muddledness of unraveling the narrative also kind of takes away from that. Because this happens, and then it moves on, and then I'm like, wait, what? Who? What is happening? Why is this man even going to this length to do this?
Right.
Yeah.
And then from there, the police get called, and that's about that. Well, and then the last thing, I think, is Holmes rhapsodizing a little bit about human nature.
Holmes the philosopher, for some reason.
Yeah, Holmes says, human nature is a strange mixture, Watson. You can see that even a villain and a murderer can inspire such affection that his brother turns to suicide when he learns that his neck is forfeited. Like, sure, another one for the books where Holmes has some weird, like, philosophizing at the end.
It's not as weird as some of the things we've heard him say.
No, I still think
sometimes he gets very out of
like,
pocket.
The theorizing of, like, the joint empire of the United States and Britain is probably still the weirdest one.
Yeah, looks so out of character.
Yeah, so all said, I think pretty in line with Holmes's character at the end of this one, but also just a little bit odd.
Yes. Yeah, before we talk about, I guess, read alikes, because I don't really have any adaptations for the story, I do want to point out a wonderful little description of Hall Pycroft that Watson offers in his storytelling, because I always like to track when I feel like Watson is perhaps a little enamored with their clients and giving them weird compliments.
Yes.
And he does that here. So this is how he describes this young clerk. He says, a smart young city man of the class who have been labeled cockneys, but who give us our crack volunteer regiments and who turn out more fine athletes and sportsmen than any body of men in these islands.
Yes. See Watson as someone who is very into men who are athletic.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Broadly and he's going, speaking.
You look like you could tackle me in rugby and exactly. I would fall over. Mm-hmm. deeply, deeply hilarious. Watson, you are married, sir. Calm down.
Yeah, so not a lot of adaptations or really any for this one. I'm not surprised.
I did some I mean, there are the broad, like, some radio adaptations and sure. some things here and there. Nothing really notable, and Granada did not adapt this mm-hmm. story, which I think is one of the reasons why it's kind of forgotten, because they're just so digestible and so faithful to a lot of the stories that if they're not in the Granada canon, sometimes it's like, oh, well, they don't exist. Right. Or they didn't do this one. You know, they had a limited amount of time and prioritized other things, I think, understandably, because I mean, this one, I think you could have had this really great dramatic moment on screen, but otherwise it would have needed a lot of padding to make it into something worth filming.
Yes. I agree. So, instead, why don't we talk about some read-alikes?
Yeah, we were thinking of things that are playing with his identity theft.
Identity theft and, to me, like, some, like, heist stuff, like bank robbing and a little bit of the combination of trying to go in and steal those funds from the bank. Yeah, so I was mostly thinking about movies because I guess I've been watching a lot of heist movies and bank robbing movies lately. So The Sting slaps, highly recommend, really good movie. Mm-hmm. Also, another one with Robert Redford and Paul Newman, Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid.
I love that movie good. So much.
And then I also thought about a heist movie that I recently watched for the first time that is extremely different in tone, but also very good, was Set It Up with Queen Latifah.
Mm. Oh, no, I haven't seen this
yet. It is great. It's about four black women who rob banks in California.
That sounds awesome.
Yeah.
Is it recent?
No, it's from the 90s, I think.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I love Queen Latifah.
But I was really, like, in the sort of bank robbing headspace for this one.
I think that's delightful.
I just want it to be more like that, I think, the story. Like, I want it to be more action-forward.
That would be better.
Yeah. It would be.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Everybody loves a bank robbing story.
What did you have?
I was thinking about some other stories that play with this, like, trying to take people's identity or confusion of identity or people mm-hmm. pretending to be each other's brothers or siblings thing, which, again, I wish was more of the forefront of the story, and it's not, but that's fine. I think there are a lot of Agatha Christie stories that have this kind of vibe. The one that came to mind to me is called The Third Girl, which is this whole story about identity theft and identical twins, like, pretending to be the same person. So if you like an Agatha Christie, which is, you know, cozier maybe than this would be, but I think she does a lot of the same stuff, mm-hmm. Sometimes with similar stakes. And then also just, like, classic Patricia Highsmith.
Love
novels,
Patricia,
like,
Highsmith.
The Talented Mr. Ripley and things like that, where I think that comes up all the time in a lot of her stuff.
Strangers on a Train also, just with the mm-hmm. sort of different sides of a similar personality. Yeah, it's interesting talking about the, like, read-alikes and the watches, because there are such better examples of things that are happening. I mean, none of them are exactly the same, obviously, but they never are. But there's so many that would have much more exciting elements to them. And I think in, like, Patricia Highsmith's case, a lot more interesting, like, internal analysis.
Psychological.
Yes.
Yes. Uh-huh. And that's really what is wonderful about any of her books. It's just, like, complex, kind of awful, really messy people. Getting entangled with these situations. And I love a bank robbery story.
Me too.
So I wish that this, leaned more into that.
Yeah. But I do not anticipate any adaptations of Stockbroker's Clerk coming to us anytime soon.
I would be very surprised. Because if you're going to do it, you should just do the Redheaded League again.
Yeah. Yes.
Because I hate to be talking more about a different story in a different
There
episode,
could be
so
a
good.
Way to, like, have an adaptation of the Redheaded League, like, absorb stockbroker's clerk, because you had like the bank stuff happening, and you could just like weave some of that narrative together. Mm-hmm. I suppose you could do like a movie out of it.
Yeah, kind of just beef like it all up. That's a good
throw
point.
Some other stories in there.
That's what I would do.
Yeah, if someone get on that
to direct a movie adaptation of some bank robbing story based on Sherlock Holmes.
Yes,
which is not going to happen.
Very specific request. But talking about adaptations, we have some interesting news that has come out recently.
Yeah, so since the last time we were recording, there's a new sort of modern contemporary Holmes adaptation that's coming out sometime soonish. I don't know if it has an exact release date. And it's all a CBS adaptation. Mm-hmm. I think just called Watson?
It's just called Watson.
And it's a medical drama.
Yes.
And Watson is
Morris Chestnut.
Mm-hmm. Which is a great name.
It's a great name.
I love you, Morris Chestnut. Who's a black actor and very good looking. So I am really excited about this. What are our thoughts about another sort of... We talked, a couple years ago about House MD, which certainly is a Holmes adaptation, but a stretch. In some ways, this seems like maybe it's going to be a little bit more faithful. I can't tell if Holmes himself is going to be in the story at all or not, or what that deal is, but I guess maybe we'll find out.
Right. So it seems like Craig Sweeney, who is involved in Elementary, is going to be the showrunner for this show. I think this is going to be a lot more, like you said, like more of like House MD, like medical narrative, like the medical TV show route than Elementary was, which was a very like, for the most part, like week by week
drama.
Procedural. Yeah. So I don't know. I'm never mad at a new adaptation. Like,
no.
Like I'm never going to complain like, oh, this is taking Holmes's name in vain. This is not what Conan Doyle intended. I don't care.
No.
So I don't know if I'll like sit and watch. I don't really end up watching a lot of long form television anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But I might check it out. An episode or two, especially if there's a Holmes character, because what I'm looking for is the dynamic.
I'm reading a synopsis. Now, there is not a Holmes character, because this is what it says. A contemporary story set 1 year after the death of Holmes at the hands of his arch nemesis, Moriarty. But that could set us up for a final problem.
Yeah.
The empty
Holmes
house
returns
kind of situation.
Kind of a thing.
Which I would eat with a spoon.
Yes.
So,
that is an interesting premise. I mean, I would not be shocked if this was kind of like a medical show that has like Easter eggs for people who like Sherlock Holmes, you know? But we are Elementary fans here at However Improbable headquarters. So, you know, like, go for it.
I think it's kind of a clever... So, you know, if you're taking some kind of procedural, it's a clever spin on something. And it's nice to be mentioning it in this story, since this story is talking at length about Watson's medical practice. And sometimes I feel like that does get forgotten.
Mm-hmm. Even in Elementary, I always wanted more of Lucy Liu's Watson doing medicine or making use of her experience as a doctor.
Yeah, there's a couple of really great moments early on, but I feel like it peters out as the show progresses and she gets more involved in the investigation part. Mm-hmm. But.
Yeah.
Anyway, I'm looking forward to it. I'll watch it.
Yeah.
I have a weakness for kind of a weekly procedural and don't have one of those running right now since the new True Detective ended. Anyway, anything else about the Stockbroker's Clerk?
I have nothing else. I don't anticipate I'll read it again anytime soon.
Probably not.
Soon.
It came into my mind for many years. And I think it will exit my mind.
I will have no Just memory like of this story in like 2 years. Yeah.
No. 100%. And we'll be going, oh, what's that story with the guy and the hanging? Resident Patient is a much better story than this.
Resident Patient
is
good.
Its name.
And the adaptation is very good also.
Yes, that's true.
Anyways.
Well.
Good story next week.
Yes, I have good news to say that our next story is The Adventure of the Naval Treaty, which We had a couple of duds, so I'm excited to talk about that one because I think it's really great. You can send your thoughts about The Stockbroker's Clerk, if you have any, to howeverimprobablepod@gmail.com or reach us on Twitter @improbablepod. Our website, howeverimprobablepodcast.com, has got research behind the episodes, suggestions for further reading, links, all that kind of stuff. If you enjoy the show and can spare a moment, please rate and review.
However Improbable is created by Marissa Mercurio and Sarah Culp, with apologies to Arthur Conan Doyle. Thank you so much for listening, and until next time, dear listeners, believe us to be very sincerely yours.